You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott, and welcome, everybody, on this Tuesday. It's a mixed picture on Wall Street this afternoon as stocks are aiming for their longest winning streak since December, believe it or not. Right now, we've got the Dow up just about 19 points. S&P's fractionally lower. NASDAQ, the outperformer, once again, up by about 40. Let's get over to Dom Chu for a lot more on this action here. Dom.
Very mixed, like you said, about what's happening right now. Just take a look at the sector heat map behind me, because what you're seeing is that materials, technology, and healthcare maintain a leadership position in the trading today. And then we've got utilities, industrials, financials, and real estate, a mix of defensive and more economically sensitive sectors really in the mix here all over the board. Now, it is technology in particular that I want to focus on right now, because as you look at what the trading action has been like, on a one-week basis, we're talking about 5% gains in the technology sector in the S&P. That's important because it makes it the most improved or most high performance sector over the last week in the S&P 500. Now take a look now year to date. This is important as well, because on a year to date basis, we're talking 4.5% gains, which means it is the only S&P 500 sector in positive territory so far in 2020. A couple of the big themes to watch in trading today. Check out what's happening overall with some of the names driving that technology trade. We're talking about semiconductor stocks like Applied Materials and NVIDIA, just two of them there. On a one-week basis, you can see double-digit percentage gains. Even one of the big ETFs that tracks it is up about 5% on just a one-week basis. Watch for that. On the bigger picture side of things in credit markets, watch what's happening with investment grade and at least junk bond ETFs. Two of them here, ticker LQD and HYG. Very much a focus here because of the Fed starting to purchase some of those types of securities. And one stock really on the move today. Check out shares of Grubhub, because those shares are right now up about 36%. This on reports that Uber has possibly made takeover overtures for Grubhub. And CNBC has learned that those talks have taken place, according to a source familiar. So, Kelly, some big names on the move in trading today. Back over to you.
And interestingly enough, Uber shares are up 8.5% now, suggesting even those investors like the consolidation. As a consumer, I hope it doesn't mean a higher pricing if it happens. Anyway, Dom, thanks. A slew of Fed policymakers have been coming out against the idea of negative interest rates in the past couple of days. But this morning, President Trump weighed in favor of it, tweeting, quote, "As long as other countries are receiving the benefits of negative rates, the USA should accept this gift," end quote. Now, the markets, well, the question is this. They've priced it in a little bit on a Treasury market side. Are they starting to press the Fed for negative rates? And would that do more harm than good to the U.S.? Joining me now are Dan Genter, CEO of RNC Genter Capital Management, and Michael Cugino, who is president of the Permanent Portfolio Family of Funds. You know, Dan, this is relevant because people are trying to figure out how far this rally can go. I mean, cutting rates to, you know, -3%. Would suggest maybe a lot further. I mean, at least for the time being, and then we just have the consequences to live with for some time, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what we're looking at, Kelly, is it's something that's generally considered negative, obviously, from the standpoint of the overall economy. That, you know, you're really in a position to where you're almost in desperation, and you're at a level now that's so low that, frankly, the difference between 0 and 25 on Fed funds, and then going to 0 or a slight negative, is not going to be something that's going to be, you know, highly motivating to corporate executives to borrow additional money. And it creates a lot of problems in the financial market, especially with regards to money market funds, their pricing. You know, I think that President Trump wants to show that he's willing to really do anything and all possible ammunition is available. But it's not really something that I think is going to move the needle at this point as we go forward and causes some significant additional problems. We have a lot of other things that we need to look forward to. And that's why you're not seeing much reaction overall in the bond market.
Yeah.
The bond market, you know, has been pretty stable.
Well, and it's not so much the president's support that I find noteworthy as the fact that more people on Wall Street seem to be warming up to the idea and saying maybe this is something that could happen, maybe even something that should happen. Dan, I know you always come with, you know, some specific stock ideas. And today, Bank of America is on that list. Would you want to invest in Bank of America or any other bank in this country if you knew negative rates were coming?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you go to negative rates, it adversely affects their net interest margin and is going to squeeze them to some degree. But I think that, you know, why a Bank of America, you know, and a number of others are very, very attractive here is just really their valuations. I mean, you look at a Bank of America is trading at an 8 P.E. You really look forward at where the earnings are going to go. I mean, everybody's a little late to the PPP program, but they were actually out in front more than most. They're going to make 5% at no risk on billions of dollars of loans. All of these large corporations have tapped into their credit facilities, and so their loan portfolio has dramatically expanded. And though they're going to get hit for two or three quarters on putting in new loan loss reserves, this is not like 08, 09. I mean, it's not going to be a 6 to 8 quarter increase of loan loss reserves. It's going to be 2 or 3, and then they're going to start to book these earnings into the latter part of 2021, and profits are going to rise for these companies, and they're very low valuations now.
Yeah. Michael, stay right there. I'm going to turn to you. I just want to bring in Rick Santelli. We just had the results of the 10-year bond auction, which just came in, 10-year Treasury notes, I should say. Rick Santelli, what can you tell us? How'd it go off?
It was a barn burner. This was a really good auction. So let's go through it quickly. $32 billion of fresh 10 years. This is not a reopening. The yield at the auction, 0.70. Lower yield, higher price. This is below where the one issued market was trading at straight up 1 Eastern. And all the internals are solid. 2.69 bid to cover, the best since mid-2016. 66.1 on indirects, best since April of 19. 13.3 on directs is just shy of the 10 auction average. Dealers take 20.5. That is really a small amount compared to 27% 10 auction average. So no matter how you slice this one, a really solid auction on the long maturity, unlike yesterday's 3-year. Tomorrow's 30-year, I suspect, will be somewhat similar, and that'll be $22 billion. And by the way, this is the lowest yield ever at an auction for 10s, and it's the biggest size 10-year auction ever as well, Kelly. Back
wow.
to you.
So it's the lowest yield ever, the most ever auctioned, and yet you gave it, there was so much demand, you give it an A.
A for Apple. It was a solid auction.
Wow. Rick, thanks. We appreciate it. Rick Santelli there. Let me turn back to Michael Cugino, talk a little bit about the implications for this market. Michael, and you know, the fact that we're talking about negative rates maybe plays into this. What's your reaction to what's going on in the bond market, what that's telling us these days?
Yeah, Kelly, I mean, the fact that the auction was so robust says there's a lot of demand for 10-year treasuries at 70 basis points. I don't find that really an attractive investment profile risk reward, but that's where investor heads are at, and that's why we're talking about negative yields. I mean, I think at this point we're largely near negative yields. I think it's more of a psychological thing than anything else if we dip much further. But, you know, the 10-year, the 30-year, you're looking at negative real returns after inflation and the risk-reward right there. I mean, I think you want to own bonds as a diversifier in case we have a redo of the shutdown, in case economics don't recover as fast as we want. But those would be the only reasons, pure defensive, because I think you can do better than that with a diversified portfolio or even in an equity portfolio and, alone and ride out the wide swing. So
yeah.
I don't find it real attractive at this point, even though it was a robust auction.
You know, Michael, that's obviously on kind of the government bond side. What about corporate bonds as the Fed starts buying today? Your spreads there are still, you know, wider than normal. Would you be buying into those investment grade, maybe even those junk bonds right alongside the Fed?
Yeah, for us, it's a little bit more attractive because, you know, the Fed subsidy is significant. And I think when you start getting into corporates, we focus on investment grade and relatively short duration. And there it gets to be company specific and industry specific where you can go low on the duration and you go high quality balance sheets. The risk of default is lower and the likelihood of better yields, you know, marginally better yields, but at least better yields than what you're getting in treasuries, with decent credit quality is better. So if again, run.
Michael, you just dropped out there. Let me, Dan, ask you the final question then before we go. And I do want to circle back to the point about banks. And as you said, Bank of America is trading at 8x earnings, which is incredibly low by historical standards. But if you look at the performance of banks in Japan and Europe, if we are going that way, those bank valuations have lost in some cases 80 to 90% of their value over the last decade. And what happens if we're following the path that they've already laid out here? Negative rates, you know, massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet and so forth.
Well, I think you're just dealing with a different situation now, Kelly, and I think the market is looking at the banks and they're looking back and they're painting it with a brush that was similar to 08 and 09. And they're going in with much higher loan loss reserves now. They're going in a stronger position. I think the real question is going to be what's going to happen to loan creation. And that's the unknown, and they're being punished for that. But as I mentioned, the activity with the support of the Fed programs, what they're having in credit lines, people that are clearly going to borrow to try to reaccelerate their growth. I think when you look at the numbers at these valuations, it's not that they're necessarily going to be the strongest performing group, but to say you can go from an 8 or 9 multiple back to a 10 or 11 and still be at a huge discount to the market, I mean, that's a 20% move mm-hmm. in share prices, and I think that's very reasonable.
All right, Dan Genter, thank you, sir. Michael Cugino, we thank you as well for joining us with your thoughts on the market today. Now, investors are doing all of this, grappling with how to value the stock market at a time when many companies have pulled their earnings guidance altogether. In fact, new analysis from Lazard shows that nearly 900 companies have either withdrawn their outlooks or announced downward earnings revisions due to the COVID-19 pandemic. My next guest says guidance may not return for years, if ever, in some cases. Joining me for more on the path forward for earnings is Dennis Berman. He's managing director and financial advisory at Lazard and a CNBC contributor. Dennis, I mean, just a few companies, you think? This debate over guidance has been going on for a long, long time. Do you think this is COVID specific?
I know. Well, it's great to see you. It's a nice spring day, so I hope we're all feeling better. You know, when you put these numbers together, Kelly, you really do start to see a different picture for the earnings routine that we've gotten so used to over the past few decades. There are a number of trends that were happening before COVID, okay? So the MiFID II rules, which were debundling research from trading fees in Europe. The overall use of algos and quants to make trading decisions. That whole dance, that whole elaborate dance that we get used to that features so much into CNBC of the company guidance and whether that company guidance is met in the earnings release. I think it really is going to have a severe shakeup after COVID. As you mentioned, almost 900 companies across the U.S. equity markets have pulled their guidance. And you have to think, like, what's it going to take for a board and a CEO to say, you know what, we feel comfortable putting that guidance back in. And there's only one thing worse than having pulled your guidance, that's having to pull it twice. And so I think it's going to take quite some time till everyone gets comfortable saying, you know, here's our view for the quarter and here's our view for the year, as a lot of companies we're doing over the recent past.
Dennis, here's my central question, though. What happens, and I've heard a lot of people criticize the quality, and this is also a long debate, but saying the quality of sell-side research on companies is getting worse anyway because everybody's fleeing and going to other sectors. You know, companies mm-hmm. themselves are burdened with regulation. They don't want to put out guidance because of COVID. Is this all a good thing because the old model was so bad, or is this all a bad thing because it's going to be a lot harder for the public in general going forward to understand how they should value corporate America?
I think you phrased the question very well, as you always do, Kelly. I think in some ways it is good because companies for a long time have been trying to talk about what their long-term objectives are. And there are certain companies out there in the market that they're given leeway, they're given license to have a much more expansive canvas than others. And I think as we get used to it, if this were just a one-quarter pause or a two-quarter pause, I think we would go largely back to where we were. But at least my expectation, Kelly, is that we could have, you know, a year in which companies just aren't comfortable making that guidance. And in that vacuum, I think you'll see companies really start to talk about their long-term priorities. And I think the market, in some ways, will get used to that. Hmm. There will still be financial reporting. There just won't be the same dance of what the guidance is. And you have to remember, the guidance and earnings consensus convention really only began in earnest in the mid-1980s. So things can change, and they will change, and I think they will change because, frankly, they have to change.
All right, and I think the jury's out of whether it is good or bad, but next time it's a gorgeous day and you join us, you better have at least a window in the background, Dennis. Not this basement.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Dennis Berman joining us from Lazard. With a look at how this could change guidance reporting for good. We have some breaking news out of Washington. It's a new relief package being proposed now. Kayla Tausche has the details. Kayla.
Hey, Kelly, House Democrats have taken the wraps off a new $3 trillion stimulus package. This would be the largest in history, even bigger than the CARES Act that passed back in March and appropriated $2.2 trillion in federal funds to combat the coronavirus and the economic fallout that it has wrought. It's important to note, Kelly, that this is a marker of Democratic priorities. The House is likely to pass it later this week, and it does allow for things like $1 trillion in funding for state and local governments. But to paraphrase a White House official that I spoke to yesterday, it's likely to be a hummingbird, not doing much but making noise. It will, however, add some urgency to discussions between the White House and GOP leadership in the Senate to figure out what their rebuttal should look like and which of the existing CARES Act programs they see as effective that they want to re-up. But it is certainly a massive symbolic move by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She's expected to talk about it a little bit later this afternoon, this $3 trillion stimulus package that House Democrats are putting out to say this is what we want and this is our starting point. Kelly?
Yeah, but Kayla, you're effectively saying it's a wish list, that they don't think there's a lot of bipartisan support for what is inside this bill. I mean, where are we coming to any early sense of what might be included in the next round of support, if there is a next round?
Well, the bill, as the House Democrats have released it today, Kelly, is more than 1,800 pages. We're still working our way through it, but safe to say it has a lot in it that Republican senators will not be able to support. But it is a challenge to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to say, if you won't support this, then start negotiations and put something on paper that you can support. So this is effectively a move to get the ball rolling in these negotiations, even if this isn't the bill that ends up becoming law.
All right, Kayla, thanks very much. Kayla Tausche with the latest on those moves. We just want to show you shares of Grubhub now. Dom mentioned it off the top. They were surging today. They're now halted for news pending. So after that 36% increase, after reports on the wires, which CNBC has confirmed that there might be a deal between Grubhub and Uber, Uber shares also rallying strongly today. Grubhub shares are now halted for news pending. We'll bring you the next information that we have, obviously, as soon as we get it. Take a quick break first, though. Coming up, the Fed is boldly going where it's never gone before, to the ETF market, and specifically to corporate bond ETFs. We'll look at why this could help brighten economic prospects for not just Wall Street. Plus, Moderna gets FDA fast-track designation for its COVID-19 vaccine today. Ahead, we'll hear from the CEO of the company about its prospects. Plus, the CEO of Regeneron joins the conversation on their progress in the hunt for a vaccine. Stay with us on The Exchange. Welcome back. As markets turn more negative, let's get the very latest in the coronavirus pandemic. Over to Sue Herrera for the headlines.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Good afternoon, everyone. The Broadway League has announced that its 41 theaters will remain closed through at least Labor Day this year. Arts and entertainment are in the last phase of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's reopening plan. Reopen North Carolina protesters gathered outside that state's General Assembly today, opposing the state's stay-at-home orders. Meanwhile, North Carolina lawmakers are moving ahead with phase one of its reopening plan. And Walmart is providing another cash bonus for all of its U.S. hourly associates to recognize their work during the coronavirus pandemic. The bonus will be $300 for full-time workers and $150 for part-time workers. As always, more coronavirus coverage, you can head to CNBC.com. Kelly, back to you.
You know, Sue, I thought that announcement about the bonuses at Walmart was really well-timed as people are getting more anxious about what's going on with the economy, with every headline starting to talk about more and more layoffs. I'm trying to say, they say you had to be an employee, but you would get $300 if you're full-time, $150 if you're part-time. And this adds up to, they said, almost $400 million across the company.
It's a lot, and the company is committed to continue to do this, they said, until basically we get back to whatever the new semblance of normal is. They're trying very hard to recognize their frontline workers. As you know, Amazon is under some scrutiny and some criticism about its frontline workers, so Walmart, I think, is more on the offense in terms of that. Yeah. So they are committed to continuing the bonuses, but it is going to hit their bottom line.
And interestingly enough, there's still time. There, you only have to be employed by the company as of June 5th. Yeah, and they'll pay out June 25th, so a couple weeks still to go to get over to Walmart. Sue, appreciate it very much.
You got it. Thanks,
Sue Herrera. We've been covering the reopening of Disney Shanghai this week. We've seen the safety measures in place in the park, but what about people getting to the park? Eunice Yoon joins me now. She's live in Shanghai with that story. Eunice?
Thanks so much, Kelly. Well, traveling is definitely not stress-free, but people in China are doing it more and more because of increased health safety measures.
I'm at a train station in Beijing, and I'm heading to Shanghai. This is my first trip out of Beijing since mid-January because of all the travel restrictions imposed due to the pandemic. More people are traveling, but still very aware of the potential spread of the coronavirus. We're all required to wear a mask for our entire journey. Mine is going to be 5 hours. And just in case, I'm bringing other gear, like my protective glasses and gloves. I just had my temperature checked. If it was too high, I'd be asked to quarantine myself in the space between the cars. The staff say that the trains are disinfected every 4 hours and every hour in public areas. Early on during the outbreak, people were required to sit apart in alternate seats, and trains were mandated to run at half capacity. But today, this train is about 80% full, and passengers can sit wherever they want.
I wish I could open a window.
I've made it to my hotel. To check in, hotels in China require that guests get temperature checks and show a government-issued health code. Some of them also accept a barcode that shows where I've been for the past 14 days, or a letter from my company vouching for my health. Since the epidemic in China appears to be abating, what I don't have to do now is go through quarantine. And that makes it a whole lot easier for me and many others to make decisions about traveling for business. So, Kelly, generally, the epidemic situation here appears to be relatively under control. But, of course, people are worried about a second wave. And we do get these reports of clusters or of outbreaks. Most recently, another outbreak in Wuhan. And so because of that, that just adds to people's level of anxiety. And so sometimes that's all it really takes for someone to decide, you know what, I'm not going to take that train or that plane.
They've had another outbreak in Wuhan again?
Yeah, that's right. So right now what's happening is that the government here is quite concerned about the situation in Wuhan. So they've mandated now that there's going to be testing for all 11 million people within the city. Still unclear of exactly how they're going to be able to test all those people. We've been hearing that some residents, mainly in the thousands, have been getting some of those tests. But the way that the government works here is on a national level. If it does prioritize a city, that city does get the resources that it needs. So the expectation is that Wuhan is probably going to get a whole lot of test kits in order to try to make sure that all of those people do get tested.
Wow. Eunice, for bringing us the latest and showing us what it's like to travel in China, maybe a preview of what it'll be like here in the middle of the night, no less. We thank you for your time. Eunice Yoon in China for us today. Let's get to CNBC's Healthy Returns virtual event. It's underway now with healthcare leaders at the center of the fight against the coronavirus. Our Meg Terrell is speaking with the CEOs of Moderna and Regeneron on a vaccine. Let's listen in.
All right. I want to start where Tyler just mentioned timelines, because both of you are doing projects at timelines we have never seen before. You know, Stefan, you just got fast track designation this morning from the FDA for your vaccine for COVID-19, which almost seems a little bit ceremonial given the speed you were already moving with this program. And Dr. Fauci mentioned in his testimony this morning, it's only been something like 62 days from when you guys envisioned this project together to now, when you're already in human clinical trials and already talking about starting your phase two. And Len, with your new drug approach with an antibody development, you already set the record in Ebola for 9 months from envisioning the project to getting into human testing. And now you aim to break that in 5 months for your antibody drug for COVID-19. So I want to ask you both, how are you doing this, shattering these timelines, even from the timelines you set at the beginning of this project? And Len, let's start with you. What are you doing differently here that's allowing you to speed this up so much?
Sure. So thanks for having us, Meg. Let me just start out by saying that what we're going to talk about here is reflective of decades of investment. People who know Regeneron and have followed us for a while knew that the first 25 years of the company, we actually lost money every single year. But we continue to invest in technology. And the technology is getting better and better and better. And we've used this technology as a way to make human antibodies. What the immune system normally does when it's faced with a virus, it makes antibodies because it wants to fight this invader. When we have an effective vaccine, hopefully Stefan and others will bring that to the market, a vaccine tricks the body into making these antibodies. But no matter what, it takes some time and it takes some work on the body. So even on day one, you're not ready to go if you've seen a new bug. It takes a while. We can make these antibodies in our new technology. As you said, normally it takes years and years to do all this. We sped it up with Ebola. We knew that there was a big problem. And the Ebola opportunity taught us a lot of things. We could set the land speed record of getting into patients in about 9 months. Now we hope to do it in 5 months. Our team was just entirely focused. The day that they had the sequence, they were on this new virus. They were making what they needed to make. They were putting the virus in the magical mice. We were doing things in parallel. We were taking risks. And this, I think, speaks to the fact that everybody has to understand this only happens when you have a robust biotechnology industry that is invested in technology and biology for decades.
Absolutely. Stefan, tell us a little bit about what you're doing differently here in terms of envisioning the trials even taking place on top of one another. As you get certain data from one, you're starting the next. How are you managing to compress these timelines in such an unprecedented way?
So I think it's a bit similar to what Len just said. First, the technology. We have, as you know, Meg, invested for now 9 years in the technology, maybe $600-700 million just going into pure science. This is the 10th vaccine we are putting into clinical studies. So there's been a lot of learning there. We have worked with Dr. Tony Sfarchi's team on the Middle East respiratory syndrome, another coronavirus, for almost 2 years now, and our manufacturing plant. When we build our manufacturing plant, a lot of people, said, this is too early, you guys are crazy. And if we had worked with contract manufacturers, we could never have moved so fast. And I think, of course, the FDA and the dialogue we've had with the FDA, which is almost literally daily, as we have questions, as we're trying together to figure out how do we move fast but safely. In everything we do, safety is extremely important. And of course, even more with vaccines, because you give vaccines to healthy people in your clinical studies, but also commercially down the road if we get there. And so safety is very important. So one of the things we've done is, as the phase two is going to start, any day now, is really to think about what is the minimum body of data we need given the risk reward to start the phase two. And what we agreed is that safety was very important, to have a safety from a phase one. But in normal times, we would have waited for antibody levels, look at all the data, ask experts, and only then start to make the phase two material if success in phase one, and then recruit and start the site for phase two. So here we say, look, life's at stake. Let's make the phase two material at risk during the phase one. Let's not wait for the immunogenicity, the neutralization antibody data. Let's just go into phase two as soon as we know the safety of a phase one is positive.
And so you got the go-ahead from the FDA to start the phase two, knowing the safety from the phase one is positive. When will we get to see those phase one data?
So as soon as the NIH and ourselves feel that there is data to be shared, so as you know, the phase one study is being conducted by Dr. Tony Fauci and his team. So as soon as we have data that makes sense, we will, of course, share it. We know everybody is eager to see the data. And I would say same thing on the preclinical data. As you know, in some therapeutic area like cancer that Len and his company know very well, preclinical models are complicated to translate into human. But in infectious disease, that has been shown by many companies before us, if you get the right animal model, you can do a challenge into an animal where you vaccinate them and then you give them a very high dose of a virus. And you can see, are we getting protection? And so that also preclinical work should be published pretty soon now.
I'm sure we'll be looking eagerly to see that. Len, I wonder if you can tell us just a little bit about your confidence level in your antibody approach working. When you talk to a lot of people who know the industry well, including Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who we had on earlier, he always brings up Regeneron as one of the companies he's watching to give us a new tool potentially come the fall. And you have done this, of course, for Ebola just recently using your magical mice, as you call them. So, we hear about there's only a 10% success rate in getting a new drug across the finish line when you start the development. But where would you put your probability of success in COVID-19 for your antibody approach?
That's a great question, Meg. I appreciate Dr. Gottlieb's mentioning of what we do. I have to say that we're pretty optimistic for two different reasons. The first reason is what we're trying to do is simply to imitate what nature normally does. If you think about a newborn or a baby developing in utero, that baby doesn't have a great immune system. So what does nature do? The mother sends her antibodies across the placenta so that if anything gets to the baby, that baby is protected by those antibodies. That's a passive transfer of her antibodies to the baby's antibodies. After that baby is born, the first mother's milk and subsequent to that, milk provides antibodies because the baby's immune system is really not up to snuff. So this passive transfer of antibodies is a very natural thing, and it goes on all the time, as I said, in those contexts. But it was also shown, actually, the first Nobel Prize ever awarded for medicine or physiology was for immunology, where von Behring had discovered that if you took people who were already exposed to diphtheria, they had an antibody that could be given to other people, and it could help them recover from diphtheria. So the concept of passive transfer is something we're just trying to imitate, so it gives us great optimism.
And that's the CEO of Regeneron and the CEO of Moderna speaking with our own Meg Terrell. A big thanks to them for sharing part of that discussion with us today. If you missed the whole event, you can start to finish online this Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Head on over to CNBC's Facebook page, YouTube, or CNBC.com, and you can catch that whole discussion. Coming up here on The Exchange today, the Fed starts buying corporate bonds in an unprecedented relief effort. What winners and losers does it create? We'll explore that. Plus, bankruptcies have already begun in the retail sector, and there could be many more to come. A look at which names could be next and what could prevent that. And finally, WeWork is reeling from its pulled IPO, this pandemic, and a likely recession. The company's new CEO joined Squawk Box for his first TV interview earlier today, and he gave some answers about how much rent the company is currently able to collect and to pay.
We've paid our rent in over 80% of our locations in April and May. The remaining location, we're just in discussions with our landlords in a friendly way, and therefore we plan to make whole on our entire obligation. I do believe in the trickle-down economy. If I stop paying my rents, the landlords can't make their mortgage payments, and then it's a domino effect. On the collection side, we've collected over 70% of our rents in the month of April. And we are working with small, medium businesses in deferrals, freezing of rents, and different aspects with them.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's get a check on the markets a little about half past the hour. And we're heading towards the lows of the day. No real catalyst right now. The selling pressure started at the top of the hour. Dow's down 123. That's a 0.5% decline. S&P's down 18, similar amount. NASDAQ continues to outperform, relatively speaking, although it's also now negative on the day, just by 16 points. And today is yet another historic milestone for the Fed. It marks the beginning of its program to purchase corporate bonds and the ETFs tracking them. The buying targets fallen angels downgraded as a result of this pandemic. And since the Fed announced it would buy corporate bonds, there's been a massive wave of debt issued, more than $500 billion. And at a breakneck pace, year over year, this issuance has almost doubled. Let's bring in Winnie Caesar. She's head of credit strategy at Wells Fargo Securities. Winnie, it's great to see you today. And perhaps most interesting to me is the fact that spreads still are pretty wide by historical standards. So this program has started to help, but it suggests there's a ways still it could go.
Yes, I definitely think that there is the ways that it can go. IG spreads are still north of 200 basis points. We consider that stressed or recession-like territory, which is absolutely appropriate given what's going on in the broader economy. So Fed intervention so far, or at least anticipated intervention until today, really supported the segments of the market that the Fed very specifically said it was going to start to intervene in. That would be the front end of the high-grade corporate credit market, and then also a backstop to some recent fallen angels. Now, as the Fed program actually starts to make its way through the corporate credit markets, it should incentivize investors to start looking at some of the sectors and capital structures that maybe had been pushed to the side for more of those easy kind of first investment opportunities in all of the volatility that we saw.
Right. You know, one of the questions that I have is, they could have just bought these bonds outright, and in some cases they will be. Why buy the ETFs? You know, it's quite an endorsement of an instrument that in some ways is still very new and that a lot of people don't always fully understand. I don't know if you want to kind of get into the physics, the engineering of it, but does it make sense to you that they would use an equity instrument in order to provide relief here?
it does make sense in some ways. The ETFs are by far the most liquid instruments that are related to the corporate credit markets. Trying to actually set up a program where they are intervening in the credit markets and purchasing bonds outright in the secondary market, that will have very specific benefit to specific tranches and issuers as the Fed kind of makes its way through that program. But in terms of setting up the program from a logistical perspective, I would expect that it was much easier for the Fed to say, okay, first let's focus on where we can inject liquidity into this market in a very efficient and straightforward manner. And then as we move down the pathway in all of our different programs that we're setting up, we can start to expand the territory, expand the universe, and actually wade into the secondary market.
That's a great explanation. It leaves me wondering about one issue at the heart of all of this, which is the Fed picking winners and losers? And is that inevitable? So, yes, an ETF kind of helps them avoid that problem. But at some point, they will be buying these bonds directly. Have they made their criteria clear for, you know, who gets support and who doesn't?
So I think that so far they have made their criteria clear for who gets support right now. But as we've seen, the Fed has been willing to evolve their programs, not just the corporate programs, but the whole range of tools that it has announced in the COVID-19 pandemic to identify parts of the market that are not having proper liquidity being pushed into them and kind of retool their strategy to adjust. So for right now, what I think that the Fed is trying to do is say, listen, there was a whole universe of corporate debt that was what we view as creditworthy and or fundamentally sound heading into this pandemic. Our first key issue is ensuring that these borrowers who were creditworthy, who were solvent heading into the pandemic, remain that way. They don't want to see investment grade companies all of a sudden running out of cash flow and being forced into some sort of default or restructuring situation only because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Yeah. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, there were a number of capital structures that were already pretty high leveraged. A restructuring, a default was likely to come at some point. Was it necessarily going to be right now? No, probably not. Maybe in the next 6 to 12 months. So now we're effectively pulling forward those defaults.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed you guys even upgraded your energy sector to market weight from underweight again, maybe on some signs of stability in the oil patch and on some of the support, too. Winnie, thanks so much. It's good to speak with you and kind of check in on how this is all working. We appreciate it. Winnie Caesar is head of credit strategy at Wells Fargo Securities. Still ahead, if you have questions for your mortgage servicer about forbearance and you seek out answers online, be careful where you click. We'll tell you why coming up. And another major oil company on the brink of bankruptcy, giving top execs a big payday ahead of the bust. We'll have those details next. Stay with us. Welcome back. Might be the stock story of the day. Shares of Grubhub have reopened after being halted for news. Turns out the news was just the company putting out a statement saying it doesn't comment on rumors or speculation, that they are constantly looking at ways to prove more value to customers, not addressing reports in the marketplace today that Uber might be interested in the company. The shares are still up 33% as a result of those rumors. And Uber itself, which had been up about 8.5% before Grub was halted, is now up about 6%. So there you go. Meanwhile, shares of Chesapeake Energy are down more than 21% after earnings and news that the company is considering bankruptcy. This didn't happen, though, before giving its executives a big payout over the weekend. And that seems to be a trend in the industry. Let's get to Brian Sullivan, who has more on this story for us. Brian, what's going on?
All right. Well, there's a lot going on here at Chesapeake. I mean, think about this, Kelly. At its peak, Chesapeake had a market cap of more than $7 billion. The pride of Aubrey McClendon, the now deceased founder of the company. Well, now with today's decline, its market cap is basically $100 million, and it's sitting on $9.5 billion in debt. I want you to think about that. Chesapeake's debt load is 7,500 times that of its market cap right now. I mean, what a huge fall for this company. They writ off an impairment charge of $8.5 billion in the quarter. Still, the company's its liabilities are exceeding its assets, and the company coming out with a filing saying that it has great concern that it will no longer be able to go on as a going concern, and that bankruptcy at Chapter 11 certainly is one of the options that Chesapeake is going to be looking at. The balance sheet has been in big trouble for a long time, Kelly, and this certainly just making it worse. I mean, we showed the stock, but at some point, You're only showing it when it's down 98%, well below our normal market cap requirements, but it's got the shares outstanding even after that reverse split. I think it's important to show it. I think we have a 10-year chart. You can look at that as well. I mean, this has been a painful story, I know, all the way down. And those 6,000 numbers, Kelly, that's because it did that 10-to-1 reverse. So make that 6,000 into a 60, the 8,000 into an 80. Quickly, you mentioned the payouts here. On Friday night, after the market closed, they put out an 8K with the SEC, basically saying they're going to revise. Many senior execs are going to forego bonuses for this year, but they are eligible for a $25 million payout split amongst 21 executives, payout earlier this year if they meet certain criteria and stay for the year. Also, they're going to provide bonuses to the rank and file employees. They're going to try to keep operating when it's got to be a very difficult time and has been for a while for Chesapeake, Kelly.
Real quickly on this, you know, if it files for bankruptcy or perhaps even if it's able to avoid that, it's going to be going through a huge negotiation with stakeholders and lawyers and so forth. Will that compensation be at the heart of this? In other words, will those, either the equity holders, bond holders, you name it, be able to have a say in whether that $25 million gets paid out or not?
I don't know if they'll have a say in it because the board passed it and they filed it Friday night, but I'm sure they could complain about it. I mean, listen, Whiting Petroleum, a little different story because Chesapeake is offering bonuses to its rank and file employees as well. Whiting Petroleum, which bankrupted a couple weeks ago, they did this sort of late night, you know, so we're going to pay out the top executives. Here's $14 million. That generated a firestorm, at least within that industry. So Chesapeake, tough times there, guys. $8.5, $9 billion in debt, market cap of $100 million.
Right. And yet they're still going to try to make a go of it somehow this year. We'll see. It looks very, very tough right now. Brian, thanks. And that's what happens to all the companies with these mega, mega debt loads. Of course, Chesapeake being now the latest example. Up next, we'll talk about the ongoing mortgage mess getting messier as servicers are putting people into forbearance when they didn't ask to be. That story is next. Welcome back to The Exchange. The CARES Act encouraged mortgage servicers to give forbearance to anyone immediately, no questions asked. Turns out they may have taken that guideline a little too far. Diana Olick has more for us. Diana?
Yeah, Kelly, I spoke to one Massachusetts borrower who wished to remain anonymous, but told me he emailed his servicer, Wells Fargo, back in March just to get some information because he thought his wife might lose her income. He did not ask to delay his payments, or so-called forbearance, but he was put in the program anyway. Someone put me in this and never told me what it was, he said. No one ever used the term forbearance. Now, he only found out about it a month later when he tried to refinance his loan and couldn't because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac require all loans be current for at least a year to be eligible. Wells Fargo declined to comment on the specific case, but a spokesman said, if a customer no longer needs that assistance, we will be happy to remove them from the payment suspension. The borrower did ask to be removed on April 23rd, but he says, as of today, the loan is still in forbearance. Now, this affects home buyers as well, as the same lending guidelines apply. That's why Deborah Still, CEO of Pulte Mortgage, a division of one of the nation's largest home builders, is trying to get federal regulators to change the guidelines. She told me, we want to keep the economy going. We want to be selling homes. Let's not put unnecessary barriers in front of future homeowners. She says she has also seen several instances of borrowers put in forbearance mistakenly. Kelly?
Yeah, that's wild. Diana, thanks very much for drawing our attention to it. Diana Olick. Still ahead, voice assistants, coffee delivery while you wait and drive through at the mall. What one former exec sees as the path forward for retail is next. And stay tuned for Power Lunch with summer just weeks away. The CEO of Redfin joins us to talk about the future of the vacation real estate market, trends he's already seeing there. The Exchange will be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. New online retail data shows where customers spent most of their money in April, and there are some surprises. Courtney Reagan is here with the breakdown for us. Courtney?
Hi, Kelly. So we've seen a number of instances where the pandemic kind of accelerated trends that were already in place, particularly when you're talking about areas of online spending, even in underpenetrated areas like online grocery. So Adobe says that daily U.S. e-commerce grew 49% in April compared to a baseline before the pandemic started, while online grocery sales grew 110%, albeit from a small base. Electronics were up 58%. Apparel grew 34% in April. But there are some nuances we should pay attention to in the numbers. So retailers actually had to discount clothing very sharply in order to sell it. Average discounts about 12% when you're talking about the prices. That compares to the last five Aprils when prices were down just about 3%. So four times more discounted than normal for the month. Pajama sales, those grew 143%, but pant sales down 13%. Jacket sales down 33%. And bra sales, those were down 12%. Now, electronic sales were up, as we pointed out, but so were prices. And this is interesting because we've seen years of deflation in this category. Computer sale prices were also higher. That was interesting. And it seems like everybody wants to be a podcaster. Sales of audio mixers, microphones, microphone cables, windscreens, those all grew 459% as a category from a baseline from early March to what we saw for the month of April. Kelly, back over to you.
Yeah, so my takeaway is pajamas are up and bra sales are down.
And everybody wants to be a podcaster.
Yep, no comment. Courtney, thanks very much. Courtney Reagan.
Thanks.
For more on the path forward for retail and what the shopping experience of the new normal could look like, I'm joined by Jan Niffen. He's the CEO of J. Rogers Niffen, WWE, and a CNBC contributor. Jan, you have some really interesting thoughts about what it might be like to go shopping when you need to stock up on those items in the future. Tell me about this concept. You know, you pull up in the parking lot and maybe you're given a number and you're told when it's your turn to go into the store or something like that.
Well, I think it's very clear we're not going to want to stand outside January, February, March and go in and shop when it's our turn. So the retailers are going to have to solve that, and people are already working on it. And I used Walmart as my example, but I said, suppose you're going to Walmart, you know you have to stand outside. You're not going to like that. But if you pull into the parking lot and the Walmart voice assistant says to you, welcome to Walmart, you're 222 in line, your wait is expected to be 20 minutes, and I'll get back to you every 5 minutes. And then she comes back and she says, and could I check on the availability of the product you're seeking when you come into the store? If you'll give me your list, I'll tell you if it's here. And then she'll come back and say, if you'd rather just drive through and pick it up, you can have that in 40 minutes. Now you've got either 20 minutes or 40 minutes to kill. What do you do? Well, the self-serve restaurant or the quick-serve restaurant or something in the parking lot there also calls you and says, like a cup of coffee? We could fix you up. Need a burger? Some other store may call you and say, hey, we're having a special on X, Y, and Z, because we're going to have to be doing that to keep the customer. It's like standing in line at Disney World.
No,
you know, they have all kinds of stuff going on before you get to the ride.
It's fascinating, Jan, because what it almost tells me is, why would I need to drive to the store to do this? Couldn't I just log on in the morning and say, here's what I want from the store. You tell me when to come. You know, I'll leave my house when I'm, you know, when I have 10 minutes to go. Or if I'm waiting in the parking lot, I can listen to a podcast. Like Courtney was saying, that's why the equipment sales are way up. This all sounds like something that could help the shopping experience, you know, help the stores in the long run. But how likely is it that we see anything like this happening in the next 6 to 12 months?
You're going to see this happen immediately. By the time you're back shopping in July or wherever you happen to be, we're going back here May 20th, maybe, you're going to start seeing these exact things happen. The technology already exists. It can be done. Everybody's working on it. You're going to start seeing drive-throughs at the mall, which we don't really have now because people want that and they're not going to want to get out of their cars. So, yeah, you're going to see those things immediately, not 6 months, not a year and a half.
Yeah.
You're going to see them as soon as you start back because it's just setting up a program to make it happen and being able to get you in the system. And if you're part of, you've got the app, you're part of the loyalty program or anything like that with the store, they're going to be able to talk to you and they're going to want to do it by voice because when you're driving, you'd prefer it to be voice activated. So you're going to start seeing all of those happen right now. And it's going to be better for you and it's going to be more expensive for stores because you're going to do more and more delivery. You're going to do less walking through impulse purchases, but you're going to be a happier person if you don't have to go in the store in a lot of cases. Now, in some cases, you'll want to.
Right.
But sure, we're going to see more of what's happening right now just done better.
No, and after seeing your list of companies that may be next on the bankruptcy list, I mean, there are some names in there that surprised me. If these methods help them avoid that fate, then obviously that would be a good thing for everybody, even if it's a little bit costlier. Jan, I appreciate it. And we'll check back in with you as we see if these other companies will be able to make a go of it. Jan Niffen, appreciate your time today, sir.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to that shopping experience of the near future. That does it for The Exchange today. Thank you so much for joining me.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.